I'm very happy to be talking to Ron English today in New York. Ron is a pop artist and he's been painting for the last 35 years or so. He's been making street art before it was hip or cool or the next thing, before that term had even been coined. He was liberating billboards back in the 80s by altering the ad on the billboard to highlight what the manufacturer didn't want you to know. Famously bringing about the end of Joe the Camel. That was the cartoon character that was created by Camel Cigarettes to capture the preteen market. Ron's art is whimsical, satirical, and courageous. His skill level is high. He can oil paint with the best of them. And as well as fine art, he produces art books, art toys. And in the last couple of years, he's been creating jarring, satirical, wake up to what's really going on versions of consumer products and placing them in supermarkets. So in a roundabout way, as a pop artist, he's been kind of taking the iconic Andy Warhol soup can and putting it back in the supermarket with a bit of an extra arty punch. So hello, Ron. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hi. Nice to be talking to you.
You started off your career as a ghost artist, which is a term I'd never heard of before. What does a ghost artist do?
I guess it's not really how I started off my career, but when I moved to New York, I had to get a job. So I felt like if I should have a job doing what I wanted to do. So a lot of people use helpers to make their paintings. So I worked for Marsha Gillian King and Ronnie Catrone and Mark Gustabi. And I also painted like the schlock kind of paintings that you buy like at the those big starving artist sales.
All right.
But that was good, you know, to be able to do a lot of different styles and also to have a sense of that, you know, you have to knock stuff out. So like when I worked in the Van Gogh room, you know, maybe they wanted 4 Van Goghs a day, you know,
wow.
Not 1 week.
That's incredible. They have the similar kind of thing in China now, don't they? They have whole villages where they're knocking off masterpieces like that.
Right. And they're really good, you know?
Yeah.
But I suppose, like, once you painted the same masterpiece 4 times, that it's kind of like a rehearsing a song. It's like you don't have to struggle your way through it anymore. You know every move you're going to make, so you can make it rather quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So you would have covered, like, loads of different styles of painting in that kind of period, did you?
I worked in the Van Gogh room, and then I moved up into the Rembrandt room, which I was more interested in being in the Rembrandt room because, you know, Van Gogh is not that difficult. You drink a bunch of absinthe and paint with a butter knife and you're Van Gogh. Oh, the weirdest thing about Van Gogh, right? You know, he was painting in the 1800s during a certain time period. And then we went down to Argentina. And then these kids came up to me at my event and they said, hey, you want to go paint at an insane asylum? And I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool. And so we went to this insane asylum and they allowed street artists to come in and paint. And it actually kind of helped the patients. You know, they made their art, they made their music, and then they brought in these people, these artists, and it was kind of almost like a clubhouse for artists there. So the people that were locked up there were, I think it was very nice for them that was the center of the community. And then after we were done, after I did the mural for them, the head guy said, well, do you want to see something really interesting? So he took me to the vaults, and they've been doing this program since the 1800s, and they had saved all the art of all the patients that they had.
Yeah.
Over all these years, and during the exact same time period as Van Gogh, somebody there, one of their patients, painted exactly the same way and had the same mental illness. So it's
wow.
Kind of interesting that because he wouldn't have known anything about Van Gogh because this was before that he was known. So it the way he painted may have had a lot to do with his mental illness.
That's amazing.
So.
And did they look the same, yeah, to you? Like
yeah,
you
just
saw.
It looked like they had a bunch of Van Gogh paintings of Argentina.
Wow, that's amazing.
Or the Argentina Mental Institution.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I saw a documentary about Van Gogh recently where it was made by his descendants who live in New Zealand, and it was a completely different take on his story about, you know, cutting his ear off and his brother didn't come out well at all. I don't know if you know that his
no.
Yeah, you know, that kind of standard story we all know about Van Gogh is like his brother was a great guy and he supported him and all this kind of thing. But in this version of it, his brother was keeping him back and quietly accumulating his work and maybe wasn't such a great guy after all. And the other thing is that his brother died, I think, of syphilis. Now, I could be getting this wrong. But like within three
years. Yeah, no.
within 3 or 4 years of Van Gogh.
Yeah, he died of syphilis. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting documentary. Anyway, it's a different perspective on it. And the same with the... apparently, he ran after Gauguin with a gun the night he cut his ear off. And he came up to him in a park, and he was going to... He had the gun, and then he... You know, it was one of those kind of Hollywood moments where he looked at the gun, and he was like, what am I doing? And he ran off, and then he cut off his ear. So it wasn't the, you know, Kirk Douglas anguished, you know, scene. It was a much more complex kind of a thing, I think, anyway. But going on this documentary, you know.
Well, I suspect his friend probably cut his ear off in a fight, right?
Well, that would certainly be a more human kind of...
Well, they also think that he didn't commit suicide, that these two boys shot him.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And then that's the thing. His brother came but didn't really do anything to help him.
Yeah,
I
don't know.
In this documentary, anyway.
I would love to see the documentary, because that's something I've been very curious about, because everybody knows the myth of Van Gogh, which is, you know, the crazy artist makes all these paintings. Nobody buys any, which we already know that isn't true, because when Theo died, Theo's wife went and recovered some of his paintings that he had traded for rent. So in my book, if you trade art for rent, you've sold a painting.
Yeah, and you know the value of it as well. Like,
right. I mean... But you know, the interesting part about Van Gogh is, like, I don't really care about a crazy person that smears paint as much as I do how did that person become the biggest artist in the world? What were the mechanics that made that happen? Do you know what I mean? And if you think about what happened is, you know, his brother dies, like, maybe a year or so after him. You know, he dies of syphilis, which also, you know, says to the wife, I was cheating on you and I got syphilis, killed me. And so she's left with nothing except these terrible paintings by his crazy brother that he wasn't able to market.
Yeah.
So why at that point would she trek around and get the few that slipped out of the fingers, you know, and buy them back? Because that's all she has, and she has no way to make a living. And so what is going on? What is the real story?
Yeah.
See what I mean? And to me, that's interesting. And it may have been, and I'm only speculating, but maybe his Van Gogh's brother, his boss said, okay, now that Crazy Boy's dead, we can really make something out of it. But before we make something out of him, let's control the entire inventory. So let's make sure if any slipped through the fingers or he gave one away for rent, let's go recover that. And then we can promote this artist, and we own every piece of his work, and we know exactly how many they are. And it's a perfect scenario for an art dealer. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's what happened, but it...
Oh, geez, I would love to know plausible. What happened.
Well, like, you know, I went to art school, so everybody I know in art school can paint at a certain level, and most people could probably reproduce a Van Gogh. And to me, there's nothing special about what he did, except maybe that he did it first. What is really special is how do you promote somebody into being this super significant, iconic artist, you know, from being a crazy person that no one wanted to be around or have anything to do with.
Yeah.
You know, there's the miracle in that story, and nobody ever tells that, you know, and maybe people don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, no, this documentary didn't go into that side of it at all. But just when you were talking there, I just remembered another bit where, you know, the way he was locked up for a while, he went to the sanatorium. Apparently the brother was behind that. He really didn't want to go in. Van Gogh didn't want to go in, and the brother had him committed pretty much.
Mm. Well, also, I mean, I'm sure he was like an impossible person to deal with, and it must be very stressful to have to deal with him. And I don't know if you remember, like, a few years ago, the woman who's actually knew him, you know, was still alive a few years ago, and they interviewed her, and she was like a 14-year-old girl that worked at a paint store. And so he would come in and buy paint, and they were like, oh, what was he like? Was he like a genius? And they were like, she was like, his breath smelled, his teeth were rotten, and he was really mean and cruel to everybody. So I imagine he wasn't a very pleasant person most of the time. So I'm sure his brother got very frustrated with him.
Yeah.
Probably actually tried to get him into the circles that, you know, he operated in.
Yeah.
But you could see where, like, okay, like the art dealer could say, you know what, I can't, this work is like, well, the work is like a very crude version of what is already avant-garde. It's like, you know, Impressionism is still kind of very cutting edge, and this is like a really bad version of that. So it's going to be really hard for me to sell in the first place. And then you add on this really creepy guy that's mean to everybody and full of himself, you know, and once we eliminate that guy, you know, maybe I can start dealing with this art. But we can't bring him to these cocktail parties and have him insult everybody. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
But now that he's gone, we can mythologize him. And I think that, you know, that kind of happened with Basquiat. You know, I used to know him, and towards the end, he was kind of a mean, obnoxious, nasty person, and he was mean to a lot of his patrons and stuff, and because he was kind of a drug addict. But, you know, once he was out of the picture, then they get what they wanted of him, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And he wasn't there to debunk their mythology.
Yeah, 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 right. Oh, okay.
Sometimes the best thing you can do as an artist, you know, your best career move, you know, maybe not for yourself, but, you know, for your dealers is probably to kill yourself.
Wow, yeah, that's harsh.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's true, but it's harsh. Well, it's not just art, isn't it? Everybody, you know, James Dean, everybody who go, you know, once they die, they become a whole different person. Okay, well, who are, speaking of, you know, older artists, and who are your creative heroes, and are they all artists?
Oh, they're not all artists, but, you know, artists, I think, you know, like, I probably was influenced by people earlier on than I was later, although I'm still influenced by people older than me and people younger than me. And this is a weird time in art because it's actually kind of a renaissance, and there's like millions of things going on, and everybody's connected worldwide. So it's kind of a historic moment. But, you know, in my inception, I think somebody like Diane Arbus meant a lot to me because, you know, I had a very myopic view of what art could be. And then, like, I saw her taking pictures of freaks, and then, you know, like, yeah, the moment you kind of realize that she's really taking pictures of herself, that these are all self-portraits and she's trying to find herself in these other people.
Yeah.
You know, I realized that the photography could be a lot more, you know, than I thought it could be. So it kind of opened up like a new world to me. And so, like, when you're younger and you start understanding what these artists are doing, I think every new artist kind of opens up this whole new way of looking at things to you. And it kind of sets the stage for you to become your own artist.
Yeah.
And artists will never have that much influence again as you get older because you've kind of seen it all, and, you know, new things happen, but, you know, you understand the process of creating the new, you know, and it's out of putting together the old and new ways. So you'll never be as impressed with somebody or as enlightened by somebody as you were early on.
Yeah, yeah. Who is impressing you at the moment? Who's currently working?
I really like Mark Dean Vecca. I don't know if you know his work. It's kind of very graphic, and he kind of spreads it all over the whole room. And, you know, he's got really beautiful, clean lines and kind of a very distinct vision. And I've always really been partial to Mark Ryden because I think he kind of he tells the kind of weird story of the 50s, 60s childhood kind of aesthetic, but in a way that seems almost more real. I mean, it's hard to explain, but yeah, it's very dreamlike, very nostalgic, but also kind of very weirdly creepy. And, you know, I mean, some of these artists just kind of hit a note and it works, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what's your – I know you do so many different things, but what is your general kind of creative process? Like, how does a new thing, whatever that thing ends up being, a sculpture or a painting or a mural, how does that start for you, or is it different each time?
Usually I wake up in the morning and I draw like a little idea out or whatever I just thought of when I woke up. So then I have notebooks full of ideas that are very crude sketches of what the general idea is. Maybe it's a dinosaur that looks like a hand grenade or something. So I know, like, there's my idea, and then I'll go through the books and I'll pick out one. And usually I'll make a sculpture of whatever I'm dealing with and build a set. So it kind of like breaks up my work into, like, sometimes I'm sculpting, sometimes I'm building a set, and then sometimes I'm, you know, photographing the set, and then sometimes I'm making the painting, and then sometimes I'm taking that imagery and putting it out on the streets. So,
right. And what do you sculpt with? What material do you use?
Different things. Mostly clay.
Mostly clay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that, to me, maybe that's the funnest thing because you really feel like you're making something. It's very, yeah, like painting's a trick, you know, but sculpting is, you're really making the actual physical object.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you make the set, then that is, it's almost, that looked to me anyway, it's almost like a version of a still life, the way people set up still lives, and then they sort of light it, and then they'll paint it. I think you photograph it, do you, and then you paint from the photograph, is that right?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I'm not sure if, like, all these steps in the process, you know, all of them translate all the way to the finished product. And I can't tell if I just enjoy each step of the process so much that I'm not going to skip any step.
Yeah.
But I could probably get to that end goal by skipping a couple steps and, you know, have more of an output. But I'm really obsessed with every step of the process and wanting everything to be just the way I want it to be. So.
Right. And how did the toys come about? Are they made from your sculptures or drawings, or How does that go? You don't actually make the toys yourself, do you?
No, no. You do wraparound drawings, and sometimes I physically sculpt the piece just because I kind of have to solve the problem in my head. Like when I did the yin yang guy, I didn't know, like, how does a yin yang look from the backside and from the side?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, as a sphere. Because we're used to seeing it flat, yeah.
It's a baseball. I kind of figured out when I was playing baseball with my son. Right, it's like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes I have to kind of work out what I want it to be, you know, but then they're going to sculpt it in China or in Japan, so occasionally in the United States, but mostly there. But I think how it happened is the culture was created by Eric So and Michael Lau, who, you know, I think I always believe that art follows technology because artists are always, you know, looking for new technology and then a new way to trick out that technology into something that people didn't really think of, you know.
Yeah.
So it's rotocasting and it's a technique to create prototypes. So like if I work at Mattel and I make a sculpture and it costs $60,000 to make the injection mold, or you know, the production cost is so high, and then the numbers are going to go down because we're going to make so many. But if every executive wants to say, I want the tail to go this way, no, I want the tail to go that way, what if the toe pointed it this way, if everybody has to have their little comments, I mean, if you already spent $60,000 and then you run it around all these people and they make all these notes and then you have to change it. They wanted a way to prototype one so that all the execs could look at it, make their comments without spending that much money.
Yeah.
And it opened up this new in the way, you know, that I think these artists looked at it is what it also creates is a cheap way to create a smaller edition toy. So we can create something in that space, you know, between like a vintage toy or a toy and a bronze sculpture. There was nothing in that space. So I can create a toy that there's only 100 of now. So it's not quite, you know, a edition of 12 bronze sculptures, but it's not a toy either. It's somewhere in the middle. So,
And
I think a lot of American producers were getting in on the action, and originally they used graffiti artist who vaguely had characters, but they didn't have like fully developed characters. And I don't think they were having the success they wanted with those. And then they kind of looked to the world of pop surrealism, and the pop surrealist, myself included, had fully developed characters that existed in our paintings.
Yeah.
And then once they went to us, then I think they were a lot more successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen Sucklord's work?
Who's that?
Sucklord. He's a,
He was on our podcast 3 days ago.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he? I think his stuff is brilliant.
He's a funny guy, yeah.
He is, yeah. Yeah. He was going to come on my podcast, and then, I don't know, it was a kind of a scheduling clash or something. But, he's pretty hardcore. I don't know how he was on your podcast, but he's full on.
Our podcast went, you know, pretty well up to a point. But I think once he figured out that I've never seen Star Wars, I've never seen it. Yeah. So it's basically like I'm talking to a Christian. I've never read the Bible.
Or
could be bothered. And then to add insult to injury is I've made some Star Wars toys and Star Wars paintings that were very successful. But I mean, the franchise is so huge that I know who these characters are. I mean, I don't have to see the movies. I've probably seen the movies like in clips and parodies, and I could probably put the whole thing together in my head. I mean, it's not like I don't understand who Jesus is just because I haven't memorized the Bible, but anyway, so we had a little bit of a riff about that. So I'm kind of, I fall short in the Star Wars universe, which means so much to him. And then he switched to porn, and I realized that I don't even know if I've ever seen a porn all the way through in my whole life. So I really have no concept of porn culture. Thankfully, I have a co-host who seems to know everything about porn culture. So the interview went great. He kind of got to take over from there. But yeah, I was thinking, the last time I saw anything with porn was I used to use this guy, Ron Hightower, as a model because I did a series of paintings of the Black Superman in the early 80s or the mid 80s. And he went on to become like a very famous porn star. So once I was at a party and then all the porn stars went to the back room. So I went back there to hang out with them and see what they were doing. And they were watching porn and critiquing porn and saying, oh my God, I can't believe they do this or that. So I got to learn a little bit about porn from Ron Hightower, but,
wow, that's a surreal mental image you've just created there. Porn stars critiquing porn. Yeah. Yeah. That's going to stay with me.
It's also weird to be, you know, what are the most important things in our society? Like when they invented the internet, you know, the biggest thing on the internet was porn. So mm-hmm. I would say it's probably one of the top three entertainment things in our society. And I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And Star Wars is probably the most iconic piece of art created in my lifetime. And I don't know anything about it, you know, or I haven't seen it, which is, and I guess the third thing is religion. And I do know a lot about religion. So I'm okay. One out of three.
Porn, Star Wars, and religion. There you go.
Yeah. But I think people are very amused at like a weird old dude that doesn't know about a lot of stuff, you know? I mean, how can you be so culturally deficient, you know? It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, with porn, you're grand. Nobody talks about it anyway, so it's not like you're going to feel ostracized or anything, you know?
Well, evidently, if you bring it up with Sucklord, it gets talked about quite a bit. So.
Oh, okay, okay.
I think he's even trying to direct his own porn movie. And.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to finish off on that.
My wife really likes Sucklord because she goes, at least he admits he's bad. You know, everybody else pretends like they're great. He doesn't. You know,
yeah,
he kind of comes at you from that point of view, you know.
Yeah, he's got this little grumpy, you know, annoyed, leave me alone, stop annoying me kind of vibe, which I find that quite endearing.
Yeah, yeah. Once you realize that's part of his art,
yeah.
You know, and he's every bit as conceptual as Richard Prince, because every artist is a whole package, and you have to kind of look at the whole thing together.
Yeah, yeah. Just going back to the toys, are the sculptures made in the same way? Is it just a bigger version of the same kind of process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It works out really well because, you know, I can conceptualize everything, but I think it's harder for, you know, people who aren't the actual artist to conceptualize things. So if you can make a toy and then put it in front of a HO building and then people go, oh, that would be cool. Do you see what I mean? Because now they can see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to always remind yourself as an artist is even if somebody, you know, comes to you and says, I want the World Trade Center with thousands of Mexicans coming out, turning into angels and blah, blah, blah. And they throw all this stuff at you. They're not seeing this because a lot of things they tell you, you know, wouldn't even be possible. But so you kind of have to keep reminding yourself that people aren't seeing this stuff, that you have to be able to show them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like if you have a symphony in your head, great, good for you. But you got to learn, you have to figure a way to get it out so other people can understand it.
Yeah, yeah. Because of the training you had that we were talking about earlier on, you can be very versatile. And because you're technically, your skill level is, as I said, very high. Are you kind of pleased with this resurgence there is of ateliers and their kind of focus on the craft of, you know, painting and drawing?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly glad that painting's coming back. I also like that, you know, the new painting movement is like the godfather of the movement seems to be Peter Saul, who was my instructor in graduate school. So, you know, I always thought he was brilliant, and painters have always loved him. They've especially loved his early work. And I think that a lot of the movement now is being built off of what he did in the early 60s.
Right.
Painting always comes back. People love painting, you know, and people love to hate it. And, you know, it's inherently conceptual because it's, you know, you're fooling the eye and you're making people see things that aren't really there. But, you know, it sure can get poo-pooed at times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've had quite a few, you know, representational artists on the podcast. And there's a kind of common story of that I went to art college, but they didn't teach me how to paint. I had to learn that for myself, you know, so I'm just kind of curious.
Well, no, that's one thing about art school, and that's one of my pet peeves, is they don't teach you how to do – they don't treat it as a profession, and they don't teach you how to paint.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like if you went to dental school and they just taught you, like, you know, the concept of what dentistry is or how cool people look with caps, but they didn't teach you actually how to do the dentistry, you'd probably sue the school, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think having a skill set is, whether you use it or not, is a very important thing, you know?
Yeah,
you should never – because I know so many artists whose style is built around their limitations.
Right.
And I feel sorry for them because you know that that, you know, and they act like, well, I could really paint if I wanted to. And it's like, no, you can't. You've created a style that's based around your limitations. Wouldn't you rather, you know, have an expansive enough a skill set that you could create your style and let it be exactly what you want it to be? And if you have an idea, you don't have to say, I can't do that idea because I can't do that idea. Yeah. So like maybe I want fire dancing on top of water and you think that would be too difficult to paint. And you have to say, you have to have an easier idea. And actually when I was with, when I worked at Kostabi World, which he's a very disparaged person, a lot of hate him, people hate him, but he did create a weird situation where he had an idea department and he had a painting department, and the people in the idea department would make these insanely difficult ideas that they themselves would never do on their own because, you know, it's fun to have the great idea. But you realize that that's too hard to paint. Yeah. But then it would hand off to the painting department, and they would just be stuck, you know, having to figure out how to paint it because or lose their job. So.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's wild. But it worked out, yeah.
Well, it kind of circumvents the laziness of people because a lot of people will look at an idea and think, oh, that's too hard. You know, and even if you're thinking of your art like in economics, every now and then I'll do a painting where I'm just going to lose money. I'm just going to lose money. It's going to take too long. It's going to be too involved. It's going to be too difficult. And, you know, I have to face the fact that I'm not going to make money off this, but I so desperately want this painting to exist that I'll suffer through it, you know, and then maybe you can make a simpler painting later and that the amount of hours will be less so that you can actually make a profit or.
Yeah. It evens out. Yeah. Wow.
But I almost feel like that you, if you want to be a great artist, you have to not think about economics at all, and you can't think about the difficulty of what you're doing. You know, you have to separate yourself from that. You know, and with me, like I use my wife as my manager, and so she makes whatever deals get made. And oftentimes, I don't even ask how much we're getting for something because I don't want to know. Not because I want to be naive. I don't want to know because I don't want to be. I don't want to think that's not enough money, so I'm not going to work as hard on this. I just want to give everything I do, you know, my all.
Yeah. No, that sounds good. Okay, I'm going to quote you now, I hope. I'm hoping getting this right. All art is a futile attempt to cheat death, and death is the thing that gives all art meaning. Did you say that?
Yeah, I say a lot of shit.
Okay. Well, what I thought that was a great quote. What do you mean by it?
I don't know. I think most artists think that, you know, they honestly think that this art thing is a way to cheat death and be immortal, you know?
But I
think the weird thing about immortality is, you know, like people fear death, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, religion exists because people fear death. But the part of you that fears death also dies. So do you know what I mean? So you won't have any consciousness anymore. So the consciousness is the things that gives you fear. So, you know, the fear will die too. So,
yep.
But I think I think, you know, missing a party is really hard on people. Missing life is beyond their belief system, you know. So, yeah, I think people think that, you know, and we're talking about Van Gogh, and you almost feel like you know him. Like, I almost feel like I've had a drink with him, and I didn't like him, or he was kind of full of himself. But then we went and painted one afternoon, and I understood why that he was worthwhile, you know, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I feel like I know him as well as people that I actually really do know.
Yeah.
So, in a way, he still exists.
Yeah.
And we all get to benefit from his existence, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a thing that artists think about. It's like, if I said, well, you know, to a young artist, you can be Jeff Koons, and you can make lots of money and rock all over the world and have a ball, and then in 200 years, your art's all going to end up in the garbage. Nobody's going to care. You're not going to be historically significant. You know, nobody's going to be writing essays about you. Nobody's going to be thinking about you. Nobody's going to be making movies about you. Or you can be this poor artist like Van Gogh, and you can have a miserable, fucked up life. And at the end of it all, you're going to be this romantic hero, and books are going to be written, and people are going to be talking on podcasts about you. You know, 90% of the artists would take the Van Gogh route.
Yeah.
It's more appealing to them, you know. Because I think people don't quite understand what death is, you know?
Yeah. Well, of course, I have to ask, which one would you take?
I would take the Jeff Koons, you know?
Yeah, me too.
Have fun watching you, right?
Yeah.
You can always pay off some art critics to write nice stuff about you if you have to.
Yeah. What you were saying there reminded me of a thing I heard years ago about a survey they did with top athletes heading into the Olympics. And they said, if we could give you a drug that would guarantee you'd get a gold medal, and it would be untraceable, so no one would know except you, but you'd die within, I think, 3 years of taking the drug, would you take it? And I think a huge percentage, like I want to say 90%, I mean, that sounds insane, but I think it was 90% said, yes, we take it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I understand that.
Wow. Are you optimistic about the future?
In what way?
Just generally, you know, the way things are going.
I'm from America. We're the most optimistic people the world has ever known. We think Trump will be a great president.
Right. Well, I wasn't asking the American public. I was asking you.
Because he said he would. You know? Oh, I don't know. You know, life is weird. It you know, things always turn out, you know, I don't know, in the long run, they always turn out right. It's like investing in the stock market. It's like if you just kind of pick something and stick with it, usually you'll be all right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're roughly the same age as me. So you would have grown up through the Reagan years and the, you know, the imminent threat of nuclear holocaust that was so, you know, I mean, in little old Ireland, like we all still kind of we had this feeling of, well, any minute now someone could lose the head and press the button and we're all going to be dead. So do you think that's informed, you know, like, cause you hear about climate change and everything is, you know, we're in trouble. We're in serious trouble. I know for myself, part of me kind of remembers those times and go, yeah, I can remember when back then when the world was going to end and now the world is going to end. And, you know, in 100 years, the world is going to end. It's, you know, do you know what I'm getting at?
Well, I do know that that kind of bonds us as a generation. And, we were the first generation to live with the threat of complete global annihilation. And the threat is actually more intense now. You know, although it's kind of been, people don't think about it the same way. I think when the possibility is first created, there's a lot more kind of anxiety created around it. When the possibility becomes greater, people are so used to the idea of it that they don't even think about it anymore. You know, maybe now they're a little more worried about global warming, you know, because you can see like the temperatures rising and the effects of it. And I don't know.
Yeah. And then there's a whole, you know, camp of people who are like, ah, no, that's not real. We're not doing that. We haven't created that. That's just happening. And people believe that.
Well, no, here's what they actually believe. Okay. So, you know, my kids are in school, right? So they come home from school and evidently they've learned about the environment or something. And they come home and they go, you know, we keep on too many lights here and you guys don't care about the environment, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, you know, the biggest carbon footprint that comes out of this house is your electronics.
Yeah.
So let's turn off the video games and the cell phones. How about that, kids? And they're like,
Hang on a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Now they lost all interest in that. It was over that quickly. So it's kind of like, you know, wait, but I have to give up my SUV. It's like, okay, fuck the world. You know?
So tell me a little bit about your podcast. It's not coming out till September. Is that right?
Yeah. We want to get a few in the can. So, I work with a friend of mine who, Cord, who, is kind of, he's into hip hop and fashion and evidently porn.
The things you discover doing podcasts with people.
Right. And he's a charismatic. So he likes talking about stuff like that. And then my role is to, you know, I'm more into art and esoteric things like that. So we kind of tag team people. And, you know, if people want to drift into Star Wars and leave me in the dust, then he's always there waiting and he knows all about that stuff. So far it's actually worked out pretty good. Last week we had on Michelle Schacht, who has had all that controversy. And, you know, for me, I like to create a long form space where, you know, people can tell us what really happened, not what the press says what happens, because the press always kind of condenses something. And even like with Michelle, I've told her story a lot over the years because I knew her. We lived together down in Texas, and she was this person who sang at a campfire after a folk festival in Texas, then later moved to New York, and then later moved to Europe. You know, she's completely desolate in New York. She moves to Europe and figures out she's famous because somebody taped that, her playing around the campfire, released it, got a hit song in England. So here's a person walking around that's famous and doesn't even know she's famous. So, but you know, I have a very short version of that story, and I told it you know, on a radio show out in LA where she lives. And then she came up to me afterwards and says, that's not right, you know. And what I'd done is, I think instead of going to Amsterdam, that she went back to Texas and then she went to Amsterdam. Or I left a piece of the story out, which you can automatically do because you want to tell the story quickly because nobody's that interested in her. You know what I mean? But I think I realized that she had gotten herself into trouble and she was never able to tell what really happened because people just like the short version. And it cost her tour. It cost her husband. And so I thought, let's create a space for her, you know, to come in and explain what really happened. And you can judge her however you wish to judge her, but at least understand what really happened and judge her based on the real facts. And I think that there's not a lot of long form media outlets, you know, where people can really explain the real story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when I realized the podcast is you don't say, okay, sorry, we got to go to commercial.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? How many times have you listened to a show and they're just about to go really deep and you're about to find out something brand new and then they have to go to commercial and then they come back and they've forgotten what they were talking about or they kept talking about it, you know, while you're watching some stupid commercials, and when they come back, you didn't even get to hear it. And then I realized, well, this is kind of more naturalistic, and you can get more out of people this way, and you can also create a space for them to really flesh out what they want to say, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that was kind of my attraction, yeah.
A lot of podcasts actually, particularly the ones that are popular, they do have ads and they do go and, you know, they disappear off randomly in the middle of it to tell you about some photocopy or something. But anyway, it's...
Well, also I realized that this is something that people with long commutes are listening to in their car, or people with mundane jobs are listening to while they're doing their jobs. And this is kind of, it's a companion. I listen to NPR personally, but I could also understand why you might like something more long form, because it kind of shortens your day. Like if there's a podcast that lasts for 4 hours and you're sitting in the factory for 4 hours, you feel like that, you know, you're hanging out with people and they're you're talking and it's not as lonely, or it makes the day go quicker. I mean, yeah. I understand how it functions, you know, and it's kind of like the toys. It's like once we made the toys and dropped them into society, and then, you know, they're functioning as this intermediary between art and toys. And it seems perfectly logical. Why wasn't that always there? You know, yeah. And I think it's the same way with podcasts. Like once you start getting into them, you realize, wow, this is great. You know, I mean, why didn't we always have this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny. Like I started a podcast with the first book I published back in 2006. And, you know, podcasting was the new hot thing. And then it just fizzled out. And I stopped that podcast to do with that book. And then when I wrote the next book, I thought, sure, I'll do another podcast, you know. And I didn't realize it had just boomed again. It's like podcasting is huge now, you know. And what I discovered about this podcast is, and this is only through people telling me, is that a huge amount of artists listen to it. And they listen to it because they're just sitting in their studio. They've gone through their music collection about five times, so they're bored with that. And they listen to podcasts or audiobooks. And if there's a podcast about painters and artists, they're just delighted to listen to it. Which, you know, if I tried to plan it like that, it never would have worked out.
Right.
You know.
What do you think? Maybe that now there's better delivery systems for it than there were when you started, or?
No, it's pretty much the same. It's slightly easier, but not much. Not much easier, and there's very little of it has changed. Actually, it's pretty basic. I don't know why, but it is, as you say, you know, people commuting. I mean, if I was to guess, I would say people are just sick of ads and sick of being told what to listen to, because the beauty of podcasts is the fact that there's not a huge amount of agenda behind it. It's just, you know, like for me, it's just me, you know, there's just me here in my little studio talking to you, you know, there's no other thing. There's no other agenda. I can say what I like. You can say what you like. You know, I think there's people like that. There's something a bit more real about it than is something that has a kind of more commercial agenda behind it. You know,
And I think, like, you know, shows like Mike Douglas and shows from the 70s, before they realized that, before they turned talk shows into commercials for movies and albums or you know, where you were there to promote a product.
Yeah.
You know, people came in and talked about the war. They talked about, you know, whatever was on their mind.
Yeah.
And they weren't always that they're, you know, hawking a product, which I think that's when it became annoying, when everything has to be a commercial.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's disappointing. Like I saw a really nice video about people getting older the other day, and I was really enjoying it. And then just at the end, it was like made by some insurance company, and I was like, ah, oh. It's just ruined it for me. What's the most moving? What has been the most moving picture painting for you to make?
Wait, what did you just ask me?
Yeah, it's a hard question. I have trouble even saying it. It's like, what, you know, like you're painting away, you're doing different paintings. When you think back on all the paintings that you've made, is there one of them that stands out for, that was a really moving picture for me to make? The process of making it was very moving for me. Maybe nobody else knows it. Maybe you can't even see it in the painting. But for me, I remember that one. It really stood out for me.
Oh, it probably was not one painting, but it was probably, I did a series of paintings with my children. So where I was doing photo sessions with them and dressing them up and then painting them. And you know, it almost went by so fast, and I was just desperately trying to capture them at every stage of their lives. And it's something I can't go back to, because now they're grown and that's over. So I think that was the most special ones for me.
Right.
Because I can just keep building sets and models, and I can do that for the rest of my life. But, you know, maybe I'll have grandkids. I don't know. Maybe that I'll exploit them. But I'll never have in-house models that – and also, you know, you kind of – you know, and it's kind of creepy in a way. But, you know, you just – I don't know. I mean, it's annoying. But, you know, like if you ever meet a mother, she just thinks her kids are probably the most beautiful kids ever created in the history of the world. And most parents think that. And, you know, it's annoying to other people. But – it was kind of an indulgence to be able to do that, because you think your kids are the cutest kids ever, and to be able to paint them. And then, you know, I made a few of those paintings and just thought, well, I'll just keep these and then I'll get back to painting something I can actually sell. But they actually took off. So that was, I think to me, that was the coolest paintings.
All right. Very good.
I wish I could have kept all those.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got some, have you?
Yeah. A couple. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want them all. If I ever, like, you know, if I ever got, like, super rich, you know, won the lottery or something, I think the first thing I'd do is I'd try to buy back a lot of my art.
Really?
Yeah.
And what would you do with it?
I would build my own museum for it and walk around, especially the paintings of the kids. I would want those back.
Right.
But, you know, that's just a fantasy. Nobody ever gets to do that.
Yeah. I think somebody did, but I can't remember who. So I heard about some artist that was able to do that. What's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment as an artist?
Earning money.
Really?
Yeah, I'm always struggling to get more money.
Okay. I'm surprised to hear that, because you seem like, from the outside, very successful.
I spend lots of money.
Oh, okay.
The sculptures are expensive to produce, and I have three studios. I can't even count anymore. You know, and the bigger you make stuff, the more, you know, more expenses you incur, and, you know, transportation, and yeah, it just eats up a lot of money.
Okay, and you're saying your wife is your manager. So does that cause a lot of, like, difficulty between you, or is she on board with all that, or how does that work out?
It took 20 years to talk her into doing it, I guess. But yeah, everything got drastically better very quickly. Do you know what I mean? Because before, you know, I had Vicki Hamilton, who she managed Guns N' Roses and Poison and stuff back in the day, and I think that she got sick of all the crazy bands, and I don't know. Somehow she thought artists were easier to deal with. but you realize that they don't work that hard for you. Do you know what I mean? You know, maybe they work a few hours a week trying to get you some deal instead of having somebody work full time. You know,
right.
So, you know, it's a hard job, because you kind of have to read contracts and be a lawyer, and you have to decipher, you know, who I'm going to deal with, who I'm not going to deal with, what I'm going to do, what I'm not going to do, and
yeah,
it's a really lot of work, you know.
Yeah, well, she obviously has great taste, because she put me through to you, so you know that speaks very highly for her.
Well, she thought I would like you, so there. That's cool. No, yeah, but you know, you kind of have to know who you are and what you're doing, and you know what I mean.
Yeah. So if I understand you, she's only recently started to act as your manager. Is that right?
Oh no, we've been together forever. So yeah, maybe 4 or 5 years more.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of artists are partners with, you know, like it's a husband and wife, and one's doing the business and one's making the art.
Yeah.
So like Tara McPherson has the same kind of arrangement, and different artists have it. It because you're a small business, and that's the weird spot, because that's where all the money passes through. And it's hard to find somebody that's honest and trustworthy to, you know, be in that position.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you share the same bank account, it's all fine.
So as your popularity is and your success has rose, so your projects have got bigger. Is that what you're saying? And the overheads on those projects is just what makes it hard to keep bringing the money in, bringing the cash flow in.
Right.
God,
you have a lot of expenses. I was trying to figure out, like, and I love metrics, you know. It's like, you know, you ever fly in an airplane, you know, what are the odds of the airplane crashing? Well, they're astronomical. But if you ever really want to know the metrics on stuff like that, buy insurance. They'll tell you how much longer you're going to live. They know. But, you know, like, sometimes you think, well, what would it cost, like, per hour to be me? Do you know what I mean? Does it cost $600 an hour? Or, I mean, just with all the lights and the, you know, everything that's running and up and running. And you probably wouldn't want to know, you know. It'd probably kind of scare you a little bit. You'd never be able to sleep at night because you're losing so much money while you're asleep, or I don't know. But, you know, okay, so think of – so I have these friends. They're artists. They're both artists, like a couple artists or whatever. And so, like, they sell a, you know, sculpture for $80,000. You think, wow, that's great. You sold a sculpture for $80,000. Right? Sounds like you're rolling in it, right?
Yeah, sounds good.
Except, okay, well, since there's two of them, you know, and they're not a married couple or anything, so they got to split it, and they got to split their half. So the gallery takes, you know, 40,000, they take 40,000, and then they have to split 20,000. But then it costs, you know, 25,000 to make the sculpture and ship it, and blah, you know. So it's sometimes we start adding up all the numbers. They made like $1,000 for all this hard work and effort, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess you know, most people don't talk about economics and art too much, so.
Well, funny you should say that. I was, I don't know how I came across this figure, but, you know, Gerhard Richter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently his annual turnover, no, is it his turnover or his profit? No, I think it's his turnover. His annual turnover is 120 million, his personal annual turnover.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe that. Like, that means every year he turns over 120 million. Himself.
Hmm. Yeah, that sounds extreme.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's not like the secondary market. That's not his sales. That's new work he sells.
Hmm. Well, he's in good shape.
Yeah.
I think I could work with those economics.
It's pretty wild, yeah. And his overheads wouldn't be high because I'm sure he's built a studio now and it's just painting. He's not doing any huge, you know, installations that cost a fortune, you know.
Right. Well, probably a lot of shipping cost. I'm sure he uses the best paints. You know, the paints are like $120 a tube for some of the paints. Or I don't know. He probably has about 11 assistants. That would be a typical amount for somebody like him.
Well, I saw a documentary with them, and there were only two guys there. And maybe there's more. And a manager. There was a studio manager. Yeah. So that's three.
With a guy like him, like. You know, I don't know if he's married or whatever,
yeah,
but I mean,
married,
what if somebody is that valuable, like they're like a surgeon. So if you have a brain surgeon, do you want him doing the laundry? Do you want him washing the dishes? So you want to make sure that you want him painting as much as possible. So you're going to try to make sure that everything else that happens is done by somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, true,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. So it basically cost him $1 million to stretch a canvas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh no, he doesn't do that. I mean, there's
no. I'm just saying, but it would be just so inefficient for him to do that. if your painting is worth that much money.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Then anything, the only thing you should be doing is painting. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's all he does. I mean, there was a shot on that documentary of the two assistants straining the paint. You know, pushing it through gauze to get any impurities out of it because he uses that squeegee thing. You know, and they're up to their elbows in paint. So you don't see Gerhard up to his elbows in paint, but I suppose he did it back in the day. Let's go.
Yeah, well, you create the template, but okay. Like, so I had my son at Comic-Con, right? And he loves this band, Linkin Park. And, you know, so I made friends with them. And they said, oh, we're having this private concert. You can come see us. And so at the same time, my friend MD, who has Mind Style, and he gives away toys. And every year, you know, we go to these different toy parties. And then my son, you know, will sell the toys for $5,000 or $7,000 when he gets home. And these are stuff to give it to him free. So, like, he's, you know, in the VIP room of this party, we're there. They're about to start handing out the toys. So either we can stand here and get $5,000 worth of toys for free that he can take home and sell, or we can go see his favorite band and meet him backstage. Nice. So literally, I'm sitting there watching these, you know, to go see a free concert and watch two songs. It costs us $5,000, kid. You know, so sometimes it's weird. It's like, it's kind of the thing. It's like, how much did it cost me to wash dishes when I could have been painting? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, you should definitely adopt that kind of mentality, I think. Just convince everybody that you shouldn't be doing anything except painting.
Right.
Because it's inefficient.
I try real hard, yeah.
Yeah. You can let me know how you get on with that.
Right.
I'm laughing because I know if I tried that here with my wife, I wouldn't get very far. But anyway.
Once you sell a painting for $1 million, then it becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll get back to you on that then. When that happens.
It actually probably doesn't. You know, like Slash goes, it's like, you know, I'm a rock star and I'm out here on the road and it's so much fun. Everybody's pandering to me all over the place. And I go home and my wife's going, you need to take out the garbage. You know, yeah. Don't we have somebody for that?
Yeah. Actually, that was a nice thing about that documentary, that when you got through all that assistance, and this is the Gerhard Richter thing, and he was painting, I just recognized what it was like. He was just trying to do something and it wasn't going well. And he was really intimidated by having the camera there. And he was just very vulnerable and very human and like, I don't know what I'm doing here, you know? I really enjoyed that. Just that I could recognize it, you know.
Yeah, it's weird to have a camera on you all the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, last question. I ask this to everyone who comes on the podcast. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be?
Oh, my genetic code.
Okay, I think that's going to happen anyway. So other than your genetic code, but good for quick answer. Good for quick answer. Everyone is always like going to ask this. Really.
I'd like to go to a sperm bank and go Genghis Kong on their ass, you know, and have millions of little me running around, but I don't know. Turns out that's the only thing that really lasts is your genetic code, right?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Is it? I won't be around to know one way or the other.
It gets mutated over and over again, but that's the only immortality you can really possibly have.
Right. Okay, so you're going to go with that answer. That's what you'd like to pass on to future generations, your genetic code.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll stick with that one. Yeah.
Good man. Okay, well, look, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you giving me the time and your accessibility, and I'm grateful to your wife for passing me through to you. I think what you've done is brilliant. Like, we really only, if you're listening to this, we really only have scratched the surface of what Ron has done. It's huge. I think it's made a big contribution. If you want to have a closer look, I recommend the Art and Crimes of Ron English. It's on YouTube. It goes into all that billboard thing I was talking about. But I think your art is great, Ron. Thanks very much for doing it. You've done a lot of good things in the world with it. Not saying that, you know, all artists have to do good things with their work, but you certainly have. It's been great, and thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. That was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Till we talk again, then. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Yeah.
We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps.